Live from beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by conservative commentator Bruno Barron, Democratic businessman Rush Darwish, very involved in the anti-war movement at the moment, and also Paul Vallis, former candidate for mayor of Chicago, and our program tonight coming to you from our home base at AM 560. That's The Answer. That's in Elk Grove Village, just a stone's throw from Chicago. It's nice to have you with us. Phone lines open, 1-800-723-8289. Lots of big stories happening all over the political map this week, and we will try to talk and touch base on all of those as our program unfolds this evening. I want to begin with Rush Darwish. He is the closest thing to a card-carrying Democrat that we have this evening. And Rush, when you were on this program several months ago, you alerted our audience that the way in which the president was conducting the Israeli-Gaza war was going to cause, or was in the process of causing him, deep political problems within the Arab and the Muslim community around the United States. Elaborate on that, because I think we now know that he's got a problem in Michigan and in Minnesota. That obviously grew rather quickly. Are people going to give him a second chance at all, or is that vote, in your opinion, gone?
Well, as we speak, that vote is gone. People are furious, and when people are angry, they either just stay angry or they activate. And in Michigan and Minnesota, organizers came together and made sure to mobilize an uncommitted vote. In Michigan, over 100,000 voters voted uncommitted for Joe Biden. That's a huge problem for the president, because that right there will essentially tip the state back to Donald Trump, which he won in 2020. And the same for Minnesota. Also, young voters, 30 and under, overwhelmingly are against President Biden due to his stance of what's happening in Palestine, in Gaza. And it does not look like he is making any moves heading in the right direction for a ceasefire. It's a huge problem. And as we speak, it's only going to get worse.
Is there any sign that the public demonstrations are going to stop?
No, because as long as Palestinians, civilians, children, women, as long as they are targeted in Gaza, the protests will not stop, because this is a genocide in motion.
A question to you, and then follow up from the other guests. Does Donald Trump at this moment have any opportunity to step in and deal with that problem with Democrats and Muslims?
We all have this idea that Donald Trump is a loose cannon. And if he's truly a loose cannon, then yes, he might go against the Republican agenda, if you will, and say that this war has to stop. And in the past, when it comes to war, he has been a president that says we don't want war, to his credit. But as we speak, it's hard to imagine that Donald Trump will double down and be worse than Biden. And I'll tell you right now, Bruce, you asked, well, will they end up going back to Joe Biden, the Arab American Muslim vote in the nation? Yeah. And the question is, it's not impossible, because there is a chance that Donald Trump can come out there and say some things that are really, really hatred, and that can change things.
Bruno Barron, you're a conservative commentator. You're not the biggest Trump fan in the world, if regular listeners know. But again, from a political standpoint, obviously the Democrats have a problem with the Arab American and Muslim communities around the country. Can a Republican, can Donald Trump, take advantage of that?
I wish I knew much, much more about the specific issue. I understand Russia's position, and I would probably say I was more in the pro-Israeli camp. Obviously, I'm against the indiscriminate murder of civilians, but I think both sides have blood on their hands on that one. I can't make that call, and I wouldn't make that call. I think if Trump has an opportunity, I get the sense that Trump is playing 2024. Much smarter than he's playing 2020 mm-hmm. and even 2016, and I think it shows in some of the poll numbers. So, you know, I don't know that Trump would do that. I don't know that he could. You're kind of damned if you do or damned if you don't in this situation.
Paul Vallis, I want to get your reaction to a problem that the Democrats have, and can the Republicans pick up and use that?
Well, you know, let me point out you know, let me just make the observation that we always have to be careful when we throw out the word genocide and comparing what's going on with Gaza, with what real genocide is. So I just want to make that comment. Second point.
Well, I think you should clarify that.
Yeah. Well, you know, my second point is in Syria, 350,000 people, overwhelmingly civilians, the vast majority of women and children, have been murdered in the Syrian war. So when we're throwing words like genocide out, what the hell is going on in Syria? I mean, I think there's been 2 million people displaced. So you know, and to answer your question in terms of the politics, yes, I think it's going to hurt Biden. I agree with you. I don't believe he's going to recover that vote. And you just don't know what Trump's going to do. I do want to point out that, of course, Trump was the chief architect of the Abraham Accords, which was a strategy to really kind of isolate Iran, who right. obviously is funding Hezbollah and is funding, you know, is funding Hamas, etc., is clearly a major player. Their target is not only Israel, but forcing us out of the Middle East at the end of the day. So you just never know what Trump's going to do. I think the point that you made about Trump always talking about how he's, you know, he's avoided wars and how he could settle Ukraine in a matter of weeks and things like that. You know, if he's careful, he could exploit that, but you never know when he's going to.
But when he says something, as he did recently, about if you're Jewish and you're not voting Democratic, you're turning against your religion, you don't know what you're talking about. Now, again, I have not heard a lot of Jews be outraged about that. Yeah. I've heard a lot of people in the media get outraged, but they easily get outraged anytime Donald Trump says anything. But I'm wondering, where does that come down? I mean, can anyone be able to put the Jewish vote and the Muslim vote together? I mean, can they come together on any of this?
No, probably not. And I think that's where you're in a situation like this. And if I were giving political advice as a advisor to a candidate, I would say tread very lightly and don't step in it with either side. You have the entire electorate right now, from many many different directions, is becoming completely unmoored from the old paradigms and moving to new paradigms. So I think Jews are rethinking their vote. They've generally been trending much more liberal than conservative. I think, you know, Muslims in the situation with Gaza, I don't know enough about where they're coming from and why their culture is the way it is relative to the Jews and the Democrats and the Jews and the Muslims. Everything is in a state of flux right now for what I would say are very, very good reasons that go way beyond just the war.
You know, I also want to point out that I think, you know, clearly I believe he's lost the vote that you've identified. But in his attempts to kind of bring them back, he may very well. I mean, on the one hand, he's lost one vote.
Right.
On the other hand, in his attempts to get them back, he may lose that other vote, you know, because
right.
clearly he's getting a lot of criticism in obviously in the Jewish community, those who support mm-hmm. Israel, and you know, obviously there's a risk mm-hmm. that he could lose on both sides.
When we come back, I want to get Rush involved in this conversation again. I'm Bruce Duhamel at 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border, talking about American politics. Want your opinion? 1-800-723-8029.
We can tell you about the incredible success we bring to local businesses, but it's better when it comes directly from our satisfied clients. Here's just one example.
After searching for a new vendor to handle my search marketing campaign, I contacted Salem Surround after seeing the great work they did for another restoration company in the different market. Their team of experts recommended a mix of multiple tactics designed to get my business the most quality leads at the lowest cost, making my marketing budget stretch further. In our first year partnering with Salem Surround, we recorded our best year to date, and I've told many people how blessed I was to find them. Their representative answered the phone every time I called and quickly addressed any questions or concerns I had.
Let Salem Surround give you an absolutely free audit of your current marketing and show you what your competition is doing. Then we can come up with a personalized plan that's perfect for your needs. Visit SurroundChicago.com and let our marketing experts help you achieve real success. Remember to visit SurroundChicago.com today.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hergaris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. As parents, we want our children to grow up healthy and strong. That means helping teens take responsibility for their health as they become young adults. One way to do that is to make sure they have one-on-one time with their pediatrician. That helps them become comfortable talking about any health issue with their doctors and with you. So make sure to give your teen a voice. It's good for their health. For more on teen health, visit healthychildren.org.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Come on back, and we continue with our discussion about what's happening with the Middle East, with the U.S. foreign policy, and we were talking about whether or not is there anything that Donald Trump could say or do that would be able to pull over into the Republican column some of the Democrats from Michigan and Minnesota who have voted uncommitted and are not supporting President Biden at this moment. And my question to you, Rush, is that there's been a lot said that Donald Trump really is really PO'd at Netanyahu, because Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden when he got elected president. Now, we all know that Donald Trump can hold, he can remember things like that. So as a Palestinian, knowing that Donald Trump may be looking for ways to, you know, turn his back on Netanyahu, or at least maybe treat him with maybe less respect than a head of state normally would be, does that give you some thought that, you know what, maybe Trump is a better bet for us?
The only way I would really believe that, Bruce, is if Donald Trump was truly a self-funded billionaire where he was not going to rely on AIPAC and other pro-Israeli groups to back him.
Oh,
so
I
this
thought
is
he
really
was.
This is yeah, that's the running joke, right? But he needs that money, and the bottom line is this: he is not going to sacrifice. And as Bruno mentioned, I mean, he is more composed this time, as we speak at least. So I don't see that happening. But if he really truly wants Arab American votes, he has to call for a ceasefire, and also
what about American Arab money? I mean, the Arab Americans have some money.
Arab Americans have some money. And if he wants that Arab American money to come out, first, he has to call for a ceasefire and believe in it. And number two, acknowledge that this is indeed a genocide. Now, Paul, you say, well, Syria, it's not a genocide. All we have to do is ask the doctors that went to Syria multiple times on mission trips and compare it to their recent mission trip in Gaza back in January. And they will tell you flat out, unequivocally, that this is a genocide, and the murder rate of Palestinians, innocent women and children, is much higher and faster than it was in Syria span of 6 months.
Look, Paul, I'm just telling you that they throw out the genocide theme or the genocide comment time and time again, and there's no comparison. You know, look, I'm, you know, I'm, I believe there needs to be a two-state solution. I believe that there needs to be a ceasefire. We all believe those things. But I also believe that clearly Hamas is using civilians.
It's a lie.
They're using
civilians. It's a lie, Paul. Again, you got to talk to the doctors and the humanitarians on the ground.
You know,
they've already debunked that. No, Paul, that's already been debunked. It's already not true.
Look,
that's already been stated.
Look,
the hospitals that were supposedly Hamas are in there turn out to be a lie.
Do you believe, let me ask you now, Rush, as an American, do you believe the reports of death and destruction and dismay when they come out from Hamas? When those figures are listed by Hamas, do you buy those figures?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, and this is really sad to say, it's worse because there are still thousands of bodies that are unaccounted for that are in the rubble of the catastrophe. So, no, the number to many, and again, it's not just about Hamas. We must listen to doctors. We must listen to NGOs that are on the ground. They are the ones telling the story. So it's not really reliant on just Hamas. And, Paul, even though this show is political, I have to ask you, what do you define as a genocide?
Well, look,
what's a genocide in your opinion?
Look, all I know is Hamas has been their habit, has embedded themselves in civilian areas, and they've used civilians as human shields.
Okay.
I mean, that is a fact. The bottom line is, don't tell me that what Syria is doing is not, I mean, if you define what is being done in Gaza as genocide, then I will make a strong case that the same thing is happening in Syria, where the United Nations has documented 350,000 deaths, the overwhelming majority of them, women and children.
Bruno, to you, whose numbers do you believe? Or do you believe any of them?
I suspect that everybody in this side that everybody's lying. Everybody's padding. I'm certain horrible things are happening on all sides. I'm certain that Israel is being indiscriminate in its attempt to quote unquote clean up or whatever they want to do or whatever they're going to try to do to Hamas. The idea that a group like Hamas and organizations like that, the idea that the information that they're giving us, that they're pristine and only Israel is evil, I don't buy any of that. I'm more than happy to. I think we. Last time I was on the show talking about this, I said we should have some kind of international Nuremberg trial or something where literally no side gets to shout down the other side, no protests are allowed, and we put everyone on a stand and we look at the numbers and we look at everything, and then at the end of the day, maybe at the end of the day, we know who's full of crap and who's giving the real numbers. But and you know, I don't know anything negative about you, Rush. I don't think you're a bad person or anything. I'm just more than happy to say to you, I don't trust the narrative of Hamas, just as I don't trust the narrative of the Israelis at this point in time.
Yeah,
and that's just the position that we're in.
Do you believe? I'm going to ask you and Paul this question. Start with you, Paul. Do you notice any difference in the coverage, the mainstream media coverage of this war, and has it changed much since last October? Just watching television every night, do you think the stories that are being told are fair stories? Do you think that the Israelis have the thumb on the scale of fairness? Where do you come down on that?
Can I just
jump in? Yeah, everybody, please. I want everybody to jump.
I'll just jump in real quick, and I'll try and be really, really fast. I no longer really trust the mainstream media on anything. I think that they're putting facts out there. And you'll never know which facts they're. It's the facts that they're not telling you that is the problem. So you can watch you can read a New York Times article, you can watch an NBC or a CBS report, and you can be sure that the things that they're telling you might well be facts. But it's the facts that they're not telling you that has become such a made all of them no different than Fox News in anything.
Paul, what's your answer?
Yeah, I agree, too. I mean, look, how many times has the media reported something and then they've had to go back and retract it? Even on a micro scale in the politics of running a campaign, I mean, the media so often gets it wrong, so to speak. So I think the difference between the coverage now and back in October, I don't think there's been any. You can't just totally trust what the media is telling you at any given time. And a lot of times it depends on which media that you're looking at. I mean, the bottom line is, I mean, you have such a contrast in reporting if you look at what Fox is reporting and what CNBC is reporting. So, you know, it's you really have to be nimble trying to decipher who is giving you the straight story and who is not.
Rush.
Paul is accurate when it comes to saying that, yes, because of the polarizing media where you have a Democratic and Republican shift from MSNBC to Fox. However, here's where there's now consistency, is that 1.2 million Palestinians have been displaced and have now moved to an area called Rafah. And this has nothing to do with Hamas, everyone. And Israel evacuated all the towns and have said, you will all move here. You will all, refugees, all 1.2 million of you will now go to Rafah. And guess what ended up happening, guys? Israel told them to move there, and now they start targeting civilians in Rafah, where now thousands of Palestinian civilians have been attacked. And there is no sign of Hamas whatsoever. And by the way, this has been reported equally and fairly, believe it or not, by all media outlets, including TikTok, by the way, which is one of the main reasons why TikTok is getting banned here in America, is because it is all being lobbied behind the scenes by pro-Israeli lobbyists, because TikTok is telling an unbelievable story, and the story is real, and it's people telling the story of what's happening on the ground, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing.
That's an opinion that I've not heard anywhere. But you are charging that a principal reason why the government is out to get TikTok is because they think they're promoting a pro-Israeli perspective.
No. TikTok is promoting a unfiltered. Facts on the ground depiction
fair.
Of what is happening in Gaza. 100% fair. However, fair doesn't matter in politics. It's about perception. And the pro-Israeli regime rejects TikTok to the fullest because it is so heavy on telling the truth of what's happening on the ground. And by the way, the story, everyone, is not being told by Arabs or Muslims. It is told by Americans, Caucasians, African-American, it's everyday Americans are coming on and telling their story, sharing videos of what's happening on the ground. And yes, Israel does not want that story told because historically they have controlled the narrative on all stations,
okay.
By the way.
Okay. What about reaction to that? That's a pretty startling statement that again, behind the scenes, that in this debate over the future of TikTok, one of the reasons why many feel that TikTok is bad is because they're presenting the case of the war in a fair way.
Look, you know,
that's a pretty startling charge, what do you think?
Well, look, most of the attacks on TikTok has always been driven by, in large part, Republicans, and always pointed to the connection between TikTok and the
Democrats, that's pretty bipartisan now.
Yeah, well, now it's bipartisan now, but I think most of the criticism, I had not heard that explanation yet, that basically the Jewish lobby is the reason why the momentum to outlaw TikTok has stepped up. And I have no reason to challenge that, but the point is most of the criticism of TikTok has related to China and basically other players.
10 seconds, Bruno.
I think it's worth looking into. It's something. I've been telling everybody I talk to that we're living in something close to the Matrix, where none of us knows the truth anymore, and none of us knows where we're being manipulated and take the red pill. So if someone tells me that that's what's going on with TikTok, I might not take their word for it right away, but I'll look into it.
Yeah.
But public opinion in the United States, I think, is greatly affected by the coverage that's out there, and I would say that the coverage of this is much fairer now than it was on October 8th. Back shortly from Chicago.
This is Jerry Boyer for townhall.com. At the State of the Union speech, President Biden claimed victory over inflation.
My inherited economy is on the brink. Now our economy is literally the envy of the world. Wages keep going up. Inflation keeps coming down. Inflation has dropped from 9% to 3%, the lowest in the world, and tending lower.
Not so fast. This is a classic case of how to lie with statistics. Yes, inflation is down from 9%, but that means it got as high as 9%. When Biden took the oath of office, inflation was only 2.5%. Then it spiked all the way up to 9%, the highest in a generation. Now it's a little over 3%. So let's make it simple. Prices are 20% higher now than they were when he took office. It takes $1.20 to buy what used to cost a dollar. If we buy these lies again, your dollar is not going to buy much of anything soon. I'm Jerry Boyer.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with Beyond the Beltway, and this is the portion of our program where we let our guests take a moment to introduce themselves, and we'll begin with Bruno Barron. Bruno?
Happy to be here. It's always great to come on the show. I've been coming on the show for probably about, what, close to over
20 years.
Over 20 years, yeah. Now, probably. I've been involved in Republican politics here in the state of Illinois. I did some political consulting. I had a radio show. I've done some various different messaging and, mm-hmm. and things like that. I've been kind of out of that for a while, and I'm toying with the idea of getting back in because times are so it's necessary for good people to do something.
Good. Paul Vallis, tell everybody from around the country who you are. Everybody listening on WIND in Chicago know that you ran for mayor of the city of Chicago, but a little bit more. Tell everybody.
Well, longtime superintendent. Came to Chicago, worked for the state legislature under the late, great Phil Rock, who you know,
right.
who you and
sure.
I know very well for right. the Senate Democrats. Of course, I was Daley's budget director, but then I ran the schools when Daley took over and then went on to go to Philadelphia and in New Orleans, where I was tasked with rebuilding schools after Katrina. And then I've done a lot of international work. I've done educational work in Haiti. In fact, I chair Sean Penn's, as finance chair of Sean Penn's organization mm-hmm. called CORE, which now does international relief.
Right.
And of course, and I also spent time in the Sudan as part of an education mission. So you know, longtime public servant, was a candidate for mayor. You know, lost a close one. 20 years earlier, I lost a close one against Robert Gorbis by about the same percentages.
Right.
So anyway.
But again, we will talk about Haiti. I asked you to be here because you have a lot of experience in mm-hmm. Haiti, more so than anybody, at least residing in Chicago. So we'll get into that likely later in the broadcast. Rush Darwish.
President of the Arab American Business and Professional Association. Bruce, every time I come here, I add a new title. I help organize a group that used to be Arab Americans for Joe Biden, and after October 7th, we realized, like, we need to pivot, guys. So now we are Arab Americans Forward, and we advocate for policies that means a lot to Arab Americans, and of course, people that are like-minded, like Arab Americans, that want to see justice here in the United States on many foreign policy issues. However, what's near and dear to us right now is what's happening on the ground in Palestine.
One quick question about going back to our first segment, and that is the relationship between Arab Americans and Joe Biden, which is not at a good point right now. Do you think that this treatment by the Arab Americans and Arabs by this administration, do you think that it goes beyond just Joe Biden and it could be more about the Democratic Party so that, you know, Senate candidates, congressional candidates might be losing support from Arab Americans if they're Democrats?
I got to tell you, Bruce, it is Arab Americans, but it also trickles down because Jewish Voice for Peace have been a leading advocate of what is happening in Palestine, not calling for a ceasefire. Young Americans, not just Arab Americans, are taking a stance. And this is no longer about we have to support a presidential candidate. This is about supporting what's right. And I believe we have a situation right now where it's once in a generation where on the ballot, it's not about voting for a presidential candidate. It is about one issue and one issue only, and that's calling for a ceasefire and let's protect civilians on the ground in Palestine and, by the way, in Israel as well.
Okay, thanks. We're going to move to a different subject now. Tomorrow, Donald Trump is supposed to come up with $450 million for Letitia James in New York, the attorney general. Do you think that all of this discussion about Trump's inability to come up with a very large punitive fine, I think, is helping him in the broader political field because nobody can really comprehend that amount of money?
Well,
is he being picked on?
Of course he's being picked on. And I can say that as someone who's not a fan of his, and I don't like the way he's handled some of these legal things. And my understanding, based on various different sources, is he mishandled this lawsuit pretty poorly and might not have been in the position that he's in. But then he was clearly being gone after by the city of New York. I mean, the Democrat strategy has been to hit this guy from every single side with some kind of lawfare. And that's true even if he's guilty of some of the things he's guilty of. The New York case, from what I can understand of it, there was no – I mean, this was sheer lawfare in that the bank wasn't defrauded. Nobody lost any money. The loans were paid off. But they went after him anyway for something that every single billionaire, every single asset company, every single person who's trying to get a big loan does, which is say, we think it's worth this much and not that much. Mm-hmm. And now they're going after this very punitive award. I don't know what it's going to do to him financially. Politically, all of this quote-unquote persecution helps him, whether he's guilty or not.
Do you think so? That's true, Paul?
Yeah, I agree. And I agree with you on New York. I think that's particularly outrageous. And that's a very dangerous precedent. I mean, businesses are constantly trying to overvalue their property when they want to get a loan and undervalue it when it comes to paying taxes. And they've been doing that since time began. And they're clearly throwing everything but the kitchen sink at him. And clearly, while he's obviously, you know, he's committed offenses, he's guilty when it comes to a number of things. I think both that case and the Georgia case, in large part because of the unprofessional behavior of the prosecutor there. I can't believe that she's still on the case. I just think that is helping him. I think that's helping him solidify his support, and it's feeding into this narrative that he's a victim.
We are all on the same page. There comes a point in life where there's certain situations or individuals, and Donald Trump is one of them, where logic does not matter, and breaking the law does not matter. Everything that is happening with Donald Trump translates into a base that gets more excited for him and wants to support him. January 6th, insurrection, more people supported him. All these corruption charges from Georgia to New York, his base is stronger than ever. We thought maybe Nikki Haley might come in and do something. Nothing can touch this guy, and it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
As a Democrat, how do you feel when you see and hear Democrats so gleeful in going after Donald Trump with the goal of not only sidestepping his presidential campaign, they're out to destroy this guy and his family? Would you acknowledge that?
I mean, look, I have to call things the way they are, guys, and I'm not the type of person. I think you're like this as well, gentlemen. Not everything is about Democrat versus Republican.
Right.
Donald Trump right now could be a full-out Democrat. If he behaved this way, I'd be embarrassed of him. I would never support him, and I would think he's a low-level guy. He's actually a lowlife. But ultimately, what we have here is no matter what happens, he is Teflon Trump. and you can't touch them. And the only thing that the Democrats can do is show people why our policies are better and why America is better. And that is, of course, dealing with somebody like President Biden, who also has his own issues.
Right.
And it's tough to deflect from that either. It's so complicated.
Teflon? Is he really Teflon Don?
I don't want to like stretch the metaphor, so I'll just have to say he's more like Pigpen. It doesn't matter how much dust and dirt are floating around him, the people who like him, and that seems to be at this moment in time more and more people beginning to like him. It just doesn't matter. And you know, so Rush said something very interesting. It's like we have to look at the policies. Well, and again, I don't really have anything against an honest debate with a Democrat on whether we fund a welfare program or whether the right way to do S-CHIP in healthcare or whether Obamacare is or isn't a great idea. Those are valid debates that we've been having on this show for decades. But when you look at what's going on in the cities in California, when you look at what's going on in Portland, when you look at what's going on at malls, like malls in New York having to completely be shut down because they can't put criminals away. Crime is running rampant. What they're doing on the transgender stuff and all the other crazy social stuff, and then the Trump card of them all, so to speak, it being the border and people flooding into this country, and the Biden administration is paying to have them flown in, and there's people coming, there's Mexicans coming in from Canada, there's people coming in from all over, Chinese are coming in from the small hole in the wall over in San Diego. I mean, people are like, what policies? You know, like if you want to sit there and say, well,
Donald Trump, I want to get Paul's your reaction. Is Donald Trump making a mistake by not reminding people enough about the difference between his handling of the border and Joe Biden's? Because all he talks about is what a bad guy Joe Biden is. Should he be doing a little more positive reinforcement of what he did and project that we're going to go back to those days if people vote for him?
I don't know. You know, from what I've seen and from what I've read and from what I've watched, he seems to be doing that. Now, of course, he's not the most articulate guy in the world, but he's drawing those distinctions, but I think his approach is to really say disaster will befall you if this happens. For example, there was that interview he did where he was talking to the American, unions, the auto
yes.
Unions, where he talked about basically the bloodbath, and that's what he was referring to.
Right.
You know, he wasn't referring to there being a bloodbath if he lost the election, a bloodbath as if it was a civil war. He was
right.
Talking about an economic bloodbath. But it's his tendency to do that, to not so much talk about what he did, but to really talk about to scare you into supporting him rather than to try to make a case for supporting
him. Do you think he says that and uses those words because he knows how the media is going to overreact to it, and that helps his long-term goal because it puts the media on the opposite side?
They walk into it every time.
They do.
Yeah, I have a friend on Facebook who called Trump all kinds of names for how stupid he was. I said, he did that on purpose. And he knew that they would overplay it, and he knew that they would end up with egg on their face.
I mean, look at the comments about Pritzker, for example. You know, when you read that, his comments from beginning to the end, by the time you were in the end, the mindset was this guy orders 5 hamburgers every single time he sits down to eat. I mean, it's smart as a whip.
Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont.
This is Dennis Prager. Sign up today for an unforgettable experience in Israel this October. Mike Gallagher and I are traveling to the Holy Land on the Stand with Israel tour with our trusted partner, Inspiration Cruises and Tours. This trip of a lifetime to Israel is one you don't want to miss. Register today before it's too late at StandWithIsraelTour.com, StandWithIsraelTour.com, or call 855-565-5519, 855-565-5519.
You're smart, you're busy, and don't have time to waste on the mainstream media cycle. Salem News Channel. breaks that cycle. Topics that matter from hosts worth watching. Dinesh D'Souza, Andrew Wilkow, Brandon Tatum, and more. Open debate and free speech you won't find anywhere else. Salem News Channel, not like the other guys. Watch anytime on any screen, free, 24/7. Find everything you need to know at snc.tv. That's snc.tv.
Why was the basketball court all wet?
Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if the music stopped? If the familiar voices were silenced? If there were no breaking news updates? What if your companion and connection to your community came with a monthly fee? Don't worry, we're free local radio with you wherever you go. Celebrating 100 years and looking forward to the next 100. We are broadcasters. Text radio to 52886 and let Congress know you depend on your local TV and radio stations. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We're going to... From coast to coast and border to border around the world at beyondthebeltway.com, this is Bruce Dumont. This is Beyond the Beltway, now in our 44th, or about to start our 44th year on the air. And Bruno, during the break, you were talking about your feelings towards Donald Trump, and you talked about, you know, what the Trump presidency, you know, could mean for the country. We have been talking off and on over the last couple of weeks. We've been talking about the third-party effort, whether it's Robert Kennedy or Jill Stein or a Libertarian. We've been talking about the no-labels effort. We've talked about that a couple of times. They still are having a difficult time finding a candidate for president. Robert Kennedy is going to announce his vice presidential running mate next week. Then we have the game that we play every 4 years, and that is, who is the candidate going to pick as his running mate? So is there any running mate that you think would make you more enthusiastic for Donald Trump than you are now?
I think running mates for both candidates are going to be they're never really, really super important, but they're more important this year because of Trump and his legal troubles, which we don't know how that's going to play out post-election, even if he wins. And then also for Biden, given what I think everybody's clear is, I think Biden, let's say he's the man on the ballot. I think they have to do something other than Kamala Harris, because she scares the country more than Biden being run by, you know, his administration being run by commission. So I look at Noam, the governor in South Dakota. I think he's leaning toward picking a woman.
What do you know about her? What does anybody know about her?
I know
her?
She's from a very small state that's going to go Republican anyway, and I think it might just be like some kind of way to try and pick up more women, potentially the loss of suburban women.
There's a lot of women you could pick up other than...
Yeah, her. Well, then there's Katie Britt, but she didn't really... No. She didn't really...
Her career's behind her.
Well, she'll probably win the Senate a few more times, but I don't think she's moving up based on her performance, which was... kind of strange. I don't know where that came from. I don't know.
To you, Rush, is there any Republican, again, you have basically said you're not voting for Joe Biden at this moment. There isn't much he can do to change your mind or the mind of many other Muslims, Arab voters of the United States. So I'm thinking that maybe your mind is open about Trump. Does picking the right running mate send a signal to you?
I think President Trump will have some, excuse me, wow, let me take that back. Donald Trump will at least have some options. But I look at the big picture for Donald Trump when it comes not just for vice president. Let's say he does win. Who's going to want to work in his cabinet after he destroyed each and every one of these are honorable people that were in his cabinet, and he insulted them all the way up to the vice president. So the question really is,
there's a lot of hungry politicians out there.
And they are hungry. But here's what ends up happening is you might end up having what I call bottom barrel type folks, because there's a lot of people who don't want to deal with the abuse of potentially dealing with Donald Trump. You say something the wrong way, you might potentially come across, you may not agree with Donald Trump, and he will absolutely destroy you. So who wants to be a part of that? I don't know.
Paul Vallis, what do you think?
I think Trump can help himself if he picks the right candidate, somebody who has experience, who has a reputation. There may be somebody out there willing to do that rather than just trying to find somebody.
Who is the right candidate? Can you come up with a couple of names?
No, not really.
It's Nikki Haley.
Yeah, she's
already said she won't do it.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm not counting. Well, DeSantis, for example, or, you know, maybe a heavyweight governor who has extensive management experience. The problem is Biden can't help himself because he's stuck with Harris. You know, I mean, he's already lost his Arab supporters for the most part.
And Muslims too, by the way.
Muslim supporters, yes. If they push Harris off the ticket, he's just going to further hurt himself among African-American supporters. And let me tell you, he's already at risk right now because of the border policies. Within the African-American community, there's a lot of anger about the Democratic Party and its inability to protect the border.
As a Democrat, and by the way, you are a Democrat. Mm-hmm. That was a big case in your run for mayor as to whether you were a Democrat, and you have voted Democrat, and you're a Democrat. And you even said tonight you're a Democrat. So my question to you is, as a Democrat, are you comfortable with Kamala Harris being the next in line to be president of the United States?
No.
Okay.
Back to your original question.
I mean, I think that's the problem.
I've spoken to, and I know, Paul, you probably speak to a lot of folks. I don't know how strong this idea is. But there is this idea that at the Democratic National Convention in August that there could be a hot switch, if you will, where President Biden is going to come out and say, hey, due to health reasons, I'm not continuing, and they will name the successor. It could be Governor Newsom out of California. And, hey, I got to tell you, Governor Pritzker is also right there as well. That's a possibility. And if they do that, then that will bring in a new vice presidential candidate. And people, by the way, it could be Michelle Harris. People are saying, excuse me, Michelle Obama.
No.
Bruce, you want sizzle on your show. I'm going to bring you some sizzle here, man. This is what people are saying.
This is old news. She's not going to do it. Well, she hated when her husband was president. Yeah. She didn't want to be president.
To Rush's point, I think, is a very, very good one. And I've been saying this for the longest time. I like to debate liberal versus conservative policies, and I think we have to get back to doing more of that instead of this kind of like you're a totalitarian, you're a fascist kind of stuff. But that's where we are right now. My problem with what we're looking at is I think the Democrats are in such a hard case that they have to do a hot switch. I don't think they have much of a choice anymore. Mm-hmm. And I have friends that say that's never going to happen. If Biden is on the ballot and he's running around attempting to campaign in September, October, I don't think he can win.
I think Bruno's right. I mean, it has nothing to do, by the way, with the Palestinian side. I think there's a cognitive display that we are watching and witnessing, and I think a lot of voters are going to look at Biden, and a lot of voters are going to look at Kamala Harris and say, not for me. That's a problem.
Well, what an interesting way to end our first hour talking about politics. When we come back in the next hour, we're going to talk about a variety of other things, including what's happening at our southern border and also some of the new migrants that are coming in from Haiti and what is U.S. policy in Haiti. And when we come back, I'm going to pick up on this conversation. I'm going to throw another name out for a Trump running mate. but I'm not going to do it now because I want you to come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Be back shortly. This is hour number two of our broadcast this evening. Thank you very much for joining us, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. During the last segment, I sort of teased as to a name I was going to throw out for vice president. And I want to put it in context with something else that I was amused by. This past week, I mean, I get about 40 texts a day from various political candidates. And obviously, a lot of those are from Donald Trump. And he came out with his list. This was from Donald Trump in seeking campaign donations. It was his list of vice presidential running mates, and he wanted people to vote on them. And what jumped out at me was that in the middle of his list, which includes all the other people that have been talked about as possible running mate, the one name that popped out is Ron DeSantis. This is a list that Donald Trump put out. And again, you know, there was times months ago where that was a possibility. And then, of course, because things were set on each side, the news media was reporting there's no way that that would happen. And there were reports that came out of the Trump campaign that that wasn't going to happen. But he hasn't really said anything against Ron DeSantis for quite some time. And when I saw that on a list of all the other obvious people, including, you know, Tim Scott and Kristi Noem and people like that, that was a signal to me that Ron DeSantis might be his choice, because it was odd that it was on there. And the other comment I wanted to make, which has nothing to do with the story I just told, because this is someone whose name was not on the list, but there are continued stories that he might be on a private list or a secret list. And that is the name of Marco Rubio. If you watched it with Jonathan Carl today, he was a combative pit bull. He was chomping at the bit to go after every unfair, questionable, slanted question that Jonathan Carl could throw to him. He was talking a mile a minute, articulately, on a variety of issues. And I remembered the young upstart he was several years ago. He has not said anything badly about Marco Rubio. In fact, he said Donald Trump has said some good things about him. He isn't little Marco anymore. But he is a guy who has a great foreign policy expertise, articulate, good-looking, and might be the type of person that Donald Trump would want to have be in place to replace him in 2028 when he can no longer run. Anybody's reaction to that, Marco Rubio?
I'll let the Democrats go first.
Well, I think anything is possible. I mean, anything is possible. I would still, if you're going to go into Florida, I still think DeSantis would be the better choice if you're going to go to Florida. But I do want to throw somebody that could be a sleeper. And I don't want to mess his name up. But in terms of, if you want somebody that's like really, really smart,
yes,
and will hit every Republican point you can think of, and will be by far and away the best Trump and Republican defender, it would be Vivek Ramaswamy. This guy is so smart. He understands the policies. Now, could the Republican Party, and this is going to be some tough words here, I don't believe they're very good when it comes to true diversity and inclusion, but if they can get past that, that's your guy right there. He is so smart.
Now, to hear from someone who absolutely despises Vivek Ramaswamy, Bruno Barrett.
Well, I don't think it's completely fair to say.
By the way,
let
me just jump in. Vivek was on that list. The list of all possible
running. Oh, there you go.
Vivek was on that list.
He would be my least favorite pick because there's something about the way he talked. When you started describing what Marco Rubio sounded like talking a mile a minute, I was about to say, please don't tell me he sounded like Vivek Ramaswamy.
Faster.
That's bad news. I mean, I
thought he might have been on
first
something.
First of all, what Trump understands, like Trump gets more votes out of using a word like bloodbath or they're murderers and rapists and all that other horrible stuff that he talks about. Trump gets more votes out of doing stuff like that, and he's a bit of a savant with that. Everybody talks about he's stupid. He really isn't. But the Vivek Ramaswamy word salad, like that, I don't think that wins any votes.
He's too smart, is what we're saying here for Republicans.
No, that's okay. I'm going to let that pass because I've been really nice to you. but the fact of the matter is that there is using too fancy of a language and talking too fast, and I think Ramaswamy has that problem. I think Rubio, if he can keep his mouth slowed down, and it probably would make a good running mate. He's been a relatively secure senator. The other thing I think, and this is, I want to make this point, and this is from a Ben Shapiro article, but here's the really funny thing about this race. Trump is the moderate. Trump is more moderate than, if you look at what the nation believes and what the nation thinks, mm-hmm. Trump is more moderate than Joe Biden. And the Republican Party, as many problems as it has with college-educated people, is the more moderate, more centrist party at this moment if you start looking at the policies. And Rubio fits that perfectly with stuff like the child care tax credit and understanding that there is a place for – and I say this to my Republican compatriots all the time. There is – for a nation that has done so been so successful with capitalism throws off enough excess wealth to provide health care for American citizens, and it's not socialism to do it.
Yeah,
Paul,
look,
your reaction to
I
Rubio.
Think, I think DeSantis would be the best choice. I think DeSantis would help him in three ways. Number one, DeSantis has run a state, and he has run a state successfully. Some of his rhetoric aside, his response to COVID is just keeping schools open. Florida is booming, and it's booming in part because of his leadership, and I think people would not have confidence that he's bringing somebody in who can run the country. Secondly, it would demonstrate to people out there that, particularly people who are maybe borderline thinking that Trump is unhinged, he may not be as crazy as people think he is because he's made the pragmatic choice. The third thing is he would be picking somebody who ran against him and who criticized him. And it would basically say, well, his ego is not that big where he would not be willing to bring somebody in who is going to be high profile, who is a governor with a record, and at the end of the day, that he's willing to surround himself with good people. So I think DeSantis, hands down, is the best choice. I agree with you on Swamy. I think he'd be a disaster, quite frankly.
Let me add something to this. Marco Rubio ran against him as well. Marco Rubio took a lot more crap from him than DeSantis. It was dank de sanctimonious as opposed to little Marco. So he ran. He kept his nose clean. He played well during the Trump administration. Let me just finish.
Yeah.
Articulate. And I think he's someone that on – and also let me just say is that if he were to run and win, DeSantis could appoint himself – to replace Marco Rubio in the Senate. So he has some ability to do some things. But here, the big question is, I think the news media, which, again, we shouldn't really worry too much about, but if the news media is against you on one particular point, they're going to hammer that point over and over and over again. And I think that when you look at, or at least when I looked at the list of people who were being thought of, and again, Marco Rubio was not on that list. I want to stress that. But I think the news media asked, is this a person who could be president on day one if something unforeseen happened? And I think the answer to Marco Rubio is yes. I don't think it is with Vivek, even though I like Vivek. I don't think it is with several other of those people on the list. Certainly a Governor Noem, I don't think is anywhere near the presidency, in my opinion. And Kerry Lake, he's got to win an election.
As a local business owner, you get called every week by marketing companies. We get it. We have hundreds of satisfied customers. Here's what a satisfied client recently said.
Open enrollment is going great. We're hitting record numbers. Thank you so much for this report. It really is amazing to see how the marketing is really shaping our enrollment around the city.
If you're a local business and ready for the next step, visit surroundchicago.com right now. Our experts are ready to help you take your marketing to the next level. Visit surroundchicago.com today.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bauckham examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide, available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
One more point on Ron DeSantis. He has said that the Haitians that show up in Florida, he wants to put them on a bus or a plane and send them to Martha's Vineyard. So he'll continue to be in the news, which will make everyone in the news media absolutely hold their chest when they hear that. But again, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I want to switch gears now. We've got some time left. And I don't want to have Paul Vallis here without picking his brain, and his brain has been picked for many years. But I want to pick a little bit more, because you have, more so than anybody that I know in Chicago, you have rather extensive experience in Haiti. And obviously Haiti is back in the big news at the moment with the unrest that's going on there and the U.S. aid that's going on, and also attempting to help in a humanitarian effort. So what's happening there. So take a moment and give us a little background, Paul, on what your recollections are from your time in Haiti, and bring it to today's news.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to tell you why Haiti matters, good, and then I'm going to tell you where we dropped the ball, or where the international community dropped the ball. First, a little background. When I was rebuilding the schools in New Orleans after Katrina, I was asked by the Inter-American Developmental Bank, which is like the World Bank for the Western Hemisphere, to go to Haiti after the earthquake. So I arrived there, I would say, less than a month after the earthquake. And incidentally, Port-au-Prince, which was the epicenter of the earthquake, it looked like Hiroshima after the bomb. I mean, it was the most destructive thing I've ever seen in pictures or in reality. I mean, look at the pictures of Gaza, for example, and that's what Haiti looked like. And close to 200,000 people died in a matter of minutes because the buildings just collapsed. You know, so I went there for that reason, to look at how to build a functioning school system in a nation that doesn't have a functioning school system. I think average teacher salaries are like $2,000 a year and things like that. So we went down there, and at the time there was a large international presence. The international community did not do what they were supposed to do in Haiti. What you discover when there are natural disasters is the international community, whether it's the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, UNICEF, UNESCO, the Red Cross, they all compete for the relief dollars. And why? Because that's how they fund themselves. They all take a piece of the action, so to speak. I remember, because I also went to Chile after the earthquake, I was asked by the Inter-American Development Bank to go to Chile. You discover in Chile nothing collapses when they have an earthquake because they build things so well. And I remember the budget that I worked with, the Inter-American Development Bank took half of the budget to study the work I was doing in Chile. So that's the way they operate. So what happens is there's no coordinated effort to really provide relief. They don't come up with a comprehensive plan on how to rebuild the country or, for that matter, you know, how to build a country that can have the infrastructure needed in order to allow it to progress. They compete for that money, and they become like silos. So you never have. So number one, the international community raised half the money that they had promised. Number two, 97% of that money was dispersed to the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, who then had their own programs and sustained their own programs. So that's why they failed.
A lot of duplication in those programs?
A lot of duplication, but a lot of people operating in silos, a lot of skimming off the top, and that's what happens. Let me
just stop you for a moment. At this particular moment, on this visit that we're talking about now, was that during the Clinton administration? Where does the Clinton Foundation and their fundraising come into the stories that you're sharing tonight?
Yeah, well, first of all, that was during Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Clinton went down there with the Clinton Global Initiative, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem there is Clinton, once he was out of the White House, you know, he didn't have that infrastructure of aides to keep him disciplined. A lot of people say, well, they went down there, the Clinton Foundation, was a lot of corruption. No, they could have played a much greater role bringing all these NGOs together in a coordinated fashion to develop a strategy for rebuilding the country, but they did not do that. Clinton was then off to another, you know, he was traveling the world. It was the Clinton Global Initiative.
Right.
So I think it suffered from kind of a limited attention span. I'll tell you, someone who
did Hillary ever continue to weigh in on things, or was she gone with Bill?
They did. No. I mean, look, she was Secretary of State. She had her own problems.
Right.
She had her own issues. You know, with some of the issues that the Obama administration was dealing with, like Syria. Haiti became a sideshow. But they really dropped the ball. Now, let me tell you why Haiti's important and why Haiti's different. Because people say, why do you go to Haiti? You know, there's a monument in Savannah, Georgia, and that monument is of Haitian soldiers because, you know, Haiti supported the American Revolution, and Haiti sent soldiers to help fight in the American Revolution. There's a monument in Savannah, Georgia. Imagine that, Savannah, Georgia, a monument to black soldiers, Haitian soldiers. Haiti is in the condition it's in today because Haiti was the victim of the most brutal colonial occupation of any colonial occupation. You know, half the island was a French colony. That was Haiti. And Haiti was one of the richest colonies because of the tobacco, because of the sugar. Sugar was like oil. And the other half of what was now present-day Dominican Republic was Spanish. The French model was to work the slaves to death, not to breed the slaves or have them have children, and that's what they did. So 80% of the island was slave, slave island, and 10% were mulattoes, and then 10% were French. And when you're working slaves to death, you have to control that colony with a brutality that's probably only eclipsed by maybe the German occupation of Poland. And it was a brutal colony. So it generated the only successful slave revolution in history. They defeated Napoleonic France. In fact, Napoleon, after the fall of Haiti, was so soured so much on Western colonial empire that he sold New Orleans and Louisiana to the United States for what? $3.5 million. So we can thank the Haitians for doubling the country's size in half. Now, what happened then was the French imposed an economic embargo on Haiti that was supported by the United States because they wanted the Haitians to pay for the values of the slaves. And for 20 years, the Haitians held out, and then they finally conceded, and they, in effect, agreed to pay, I think it was like 120 marks, which is the equivalent to like, I don't know, $20, $30 billion today. And, of course, how did they raise the money? They had to borrow. So who did they borrow from? French and American banks. And the cost of financing that loan consumed 80% of the country's disposable income for 120 years until finally in 1947 they just stopped making loan payments. So when you look at the Dominican Republic with its green, with its tropical forests, et cetera, and when you fly from Haiti to the Dominican Republic, it's like scorched earth, and then suddenly you can see it. It's so pronounced. Basically for 120 years, the country was stripped of its resources. And finally, that's why Haiti's different. And
a quick question.
Yeah.
Has Haiti had a good day in the last 50 years?
No, I don't think they have. Because after World War II, then with the, obviously during the Cold War, the American government put a premium on having governments in the Caribbean and in South America that were obviously obviously anti-Soviet, pro-American. You had the presence of Cuba, so you had American interventions, the toppling of Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, etc. So you had a lot of American interventions. In fact, the United States intervened in Caribbean countries prior to the Roosevelt administration, something like 20, they intervened in Haiti, I think something like a dozen times over a period of 50 years until Roosevelt just with the Good Neighbor Policy stopped those type of interventions. The point that I'm trying to make is the Haitian people are the most successful diaspora of African descent. The Haitians who live in this country and in France remit to the country of Haiti $3.5 billion a year. It doubled from the time of the earthquake, and this is a country of like 10 million. So the Haitians themselves are extraordinary people. We've sponsored a number of families who have come from Haiti, all the kids are in college now. They're thriving. So at the end of the day, Haiti is important to us because we kind of owe Haiti. We have blood on our hands.
I want to let Bruno ask a question, but let me ask a quick question. The Haitians that have come to the United States, where do they live? What states do they primarily live in?
Well, there's a large, clearly New York State, the large Haitian population. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia had a sizable Haitian population. There's a sizable Haitian population here in Chicago, too. Kwame Raoul is Haitian. He's been very active. I know his wife has been very active in Haitian charities. But Haiti is different.
He's the Attorney General.
General. Haiti has always been a strong supporter of the United States. They fought in our revolution. Many of the economic problems that country is experiencing today is because for 120 years, 80% of the country's disposable income did not go into building roads and schools and sewers. I was hospitalized 3 times for my work in Haiti, probably through infections that I got from inadvertently absorbing some of the water, which you can't drink because there's no modern sewer system. Hurricane hits what they call a sewer system overflows. Suddenly you have a cholera epidemic.
Bruno Barron has a quick question for you. You know what, Bruno, the music is the plan, which means we're about to go to a break. Paul, thank you very much for that in-depth background on Haiti. We're going to continue with that. If you have questions, 1-800-723-8029. Bruno and Rush also have questions for Paul, as do I. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bonkam examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What god are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Feel like you're trying to push a boulder uphill wearing skates? If you run or manage a local business today, you're challenged like never before. We get it, and we want to help. We're Salem Surround. We're a full-service marketing agency that'll help you increase your customer base by designing incredibly effective plans to reach your consumers day, night, and everywhere they might be.
If you're a local business and want to see what Salem Surround can do for you, visit SurroundChicago.com. Remember to visit SurroundChicago.com today.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces. Just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with Beyond the Beltway. We're in a discussion of Haiti. And Bruno Barron, you were taking copious notes as Paul spoke.
Yeah. I don't want to go on too long. I've watched a couple of things. I've seen a couple of things about where things are right now, and how there's apparently some gang chief named Barbecue who's literally running the country right now.
Yeah.
In theory. And the question I have for Paul, and I'd like a little bit of a detailed answer, is how do you? I agree with you that this is something that has to be fixed because it's close enough to our borders. And this is where I always chide my Republican compatriots, like, well, who cares? It's just another S-hole country,
Yeah. And
we don't have to do anything about it, and we'll just sink the boats as they come across. It's like, no, you can't have this kind of cancerous stuff happening at your border, and you have to find a way to fix it. And the other part of it, too, is that they're human beings, and they deserve what human beings deserve. So I'm not saying bankrupt the entire United States to do this, but first question is, A, how do you fix it? And I'll just throw my thoughts in here. It has to be something aggressive and creative. It can't be more money to the same NGOs that have destroyed things.
No, it can't be. Look, where they dropped the ball is Haiti fatigue, and you know what the international presence when President Preval was there, and he had been president. He had been a president once, was deposed, and then came back became president again.
Was he there?
When I was there.
Okay.
And then, he was succeeded in an election by this President Martelly, who, of course, was a corrupt performer. He was a poor performer, and he was corrupt. But the point is, when they had the large inter-American presence, and they had basically, you know, they were able to stabilize the country, they were able to provide the country with the support that they needed so that the population had enough food to eat, and there's Haitians who are starving. They were getting clean water, et cetera. There was an opportunity then to begin to build an infrastructure of a modern, responsible government, but no one really took the lead. I think, you know, the Obama administration was preoccupied with other things. Certainly Secretary of State Clinton was. Bill Clinton was off doing to another country, doing what the Clinton Global Initiative does, because mm-hmm. they had created the Haitian Reconstruction Authority
now also,
that Clinton was co-chairman of, and they kind of dropped the ball.
Was that the tandem that he did with George Bush?
Yeah, George Bush was involved in
Herbert
that.
Walker Bush.
Right. But Clinton had a leadership role, and then obviously, okay. but what happened was as nothing was done, and you're talking about a country where I think I don't know what the percentage is, like 60% of the population is like under the age of 21. No jobs, no economic opportunities, no public education system to speak of. And what eventually happens is people gravitate. They form gangs to survive. And once the foreign aid dried up, once the presence, the police presence left with no infrastructure, with no modern, you know, adequately compensated police force, et cetera, the gangs just with no economic
The current president has left the country, right? So he hasn't come back. Mm-hmm. So there's no authority figure other than this gang member who's given his name as Barbecue.
What they've talked about doing is bringing the parties together and putting together like a leadership council.
Who are the parties?
And let me just say. Rather than, you know, because I haven't been spending a lot of time thinking about Haiti these days, other than to point out that it's still important and that we should not have dropped the ball. But the bottom line is, to answer your question, what is it going to take? I really think it's going to require leadership from among the Caribbean countries, from among the Inter-American Developmental Bank, for these countries to come together and to play a leadership role in the stabilization of Haiti, and that means they're going to have to come with aid, and they're going to have to be willing to put boots on the ground, and at the same time, they're going to have to demand that reforms accompany that intervention and that support.
But the boots on the ground, though, are coming from halfway around the world, right? They're right. not from a close. They're not coming from a Caribbean country, are they?
Well, I think what I'm saying is that if you're going to have a presence in Haiti, there needs to be a Central and South American solution. There needs to be – the Inter-American Development Bank not only represents Caribbean countries, but also represents South American countries.
But again, I want to put this in context to those that are listening to the program this evening. You've painted a very bleak picture about their history, mm-hmm. about why they're important, about why they are human beings in our hemisphere, and they have not been treated well. Yet we're a country that we're concerned about what's happening on our southern border. We're concerned about what is happening in Gaza and Israel. We're concerned about what's happening, in Ukraine. How do we find the focus and the energy and the congressional concern that you've raised tonight with all of these other things that are going on, and each one of them has a much larger constituency group that our political parties have to deal with?
I think what I'm saying, is we shouldn't lead the effort. It needs to be a collective effort. And what I'm saying is the Western Hemisphere has organizations that can fill that vacuum. I mean, you know, when
What's
Haiti...
the prime one?
Well, there's the Inter-American Developmental Bank. There's the Organization of American States. There are entities out there, and really, these countries need to come together. I remember right after the earthquake, the country of Chile played a major role, particularly with the Inter-American Development Bank. Mm-hmm. They took a leadership role with the rescue efforts in that country. So there are other countries that can play the leadership role. I'm not saying that we should. I'm just saying we need to herd people together and to get the other countries in the hemisphere to play that role.
Quick question, then Russia's got a question.
Okay.
Where does Russia or China, where do they fall? Do they have the abilities to come in and swoop in and become the new best friend of Haiti in lieu of the United States.
Yeah, I don't think Russia and, you know, I think Russia and China are, their new best friends is going to be Cuba. You know, okay. I think China already has kind of tried to send America the message by training, by offering some training programs in Cuba. So I think, I don't think they're going to be, I don't think that they pose any threat to us.
Russia's got a question.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know if it's a question, but I want to say thank you. You know, thank you for sharing that story because, truth be told, Paul, if somebody just tuned in the last 3 minutes, you know, you talked about an inequality. You talked about lack of education. You talked about colonialism. If somebody just tuned in, believe it or not, they think you're talking about Gaza right now.
Yeah.
Because everything you just talked about, even though, remember now, we understand that America has its allies, but everything you just talked about is what has happened in Gaza for the past 20 years. The occupation of Palestine has been for over 70 years. And a lot of people want to try and put everything in Palestine just by October 7th. And no, what we are seeing is not political. It's a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm saying thank you. Thank you for talking about Haiti because we need to talk about it. And America has a responsibility with our funds, with our resources, that we need to quickly identify what is a humanitarian crisis versus something political. And what's happening in Haiti, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in parts of Africa, these are humanitarian crises. And we have a responsibility to either help or, the very least, don't make it political.
So when Ron DeSantis says that the Haitians that are coming and will be soon flooding in to Florida, he wants to put them on a train or a plane or a bus and send them to Martha's Vineyard. Is that that being punitive?
I think a good chunk of that is political rhetoric, and it's kind of tongue in cheek, and it's kind of fun, and it's kind of Ron DeSantis flexing his muscle.
But hasn't he done that, Bruno? Though
is it because the people that are coming to America are black?
No, I don't think so. And let me just say this before it sounds like I'm dissing Ron DeSantis. One of the reasons that the immigration, migration, illegal immigrant issue is as big as it is on the border right now is because Abbott was actually first, but because DeSantis and Abbott did something that the Democrats have been doing politically for decades and the Republicans have just been getting their heads cracked in, and they just did something that was brilliant and hilarious and accurate. And they said, this is the problem you're creating for us on these border states, and we're going to ship them to your cities and see how you like it. And all of a sudden, you've got all these Democrats screaming bloody murder. It's like, so I'm not apologizing for Ron DeSantis, but I will say this, and I'll be critical. I hope he's listening to the program.
So do I.
don't play those kind of games with this situation, because this situation is not a laughing matter. What you have in Haiti is a complete lack of civilization, and it's now getting crazy, and it's time for the decent people of this world to step up and solve the problem, and to solve it boldly and aggressively and creatively, and not with the same old UN, NGO, corrupt, 90% of the money going to a bunch of fat administrators who should all be losing their jobs and cleaning toilets in Haiti instead of having rich white collar jobs in New York.
Who's going to have that political courage at this point?
You'd like to think that the way he talks, Trump would be that person, but he's incapable of thinking things through that.
Well, we all remember his comments about Haiti.
Yeah.
For example, what prompted me to write this op-ed a number of years ago, sent to the Wall Street Journal, was when he was talking about the Haitians in very derogatory ways. And I felt it important to really articulate how extraordinarily successful the Haitian diaspora have been in this country, the fact that the diaspora remit $3.5 billion, they keep that country afloat. Literally.
That means the Haitians in the United States send that much money back
to
Haiti. We've got a pause. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away.
You were going to...
Feel like you're trying to push a boulder uphill wearing skates? If you run or manage a local business today, you're challenged like never before. We get it, and we want to help. We're Salem Surround. We're a full-service marketing agency that'll help you increase your customer base by designing incredibly effective plans to reach your consumers day, night, and everywhere they might be.
If you're a local business and want to see what Salem Surround can do for you, visit surroundchicago.com. Remember to visit surroundchicago.com today.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We continue. The chaos at the southern border continues. It's we've been going for about almost 2.5 years on this issue now. This past week, a dramatic piece of video has been put now on the record. This was a dispatch that happened on the border near El Paso, Texas, where migrants were heading towards the fences there. And at some point, they were met by the National Guard of Texas, and the guard was on duty. And at some particular point, they decided that they were going to try to rush the group. And so what you had is you had, when they eventually got to actual border, they tried to climb the fences, but we're showing, for those watching this on television, we're showing some of the confrontation between the migrants and the Texas National Guard. So devastating pictures. But Paul, again, I want to go to you, because this is an issue, as Bruno mentioned. Governor Abbott of Texas, who I think is one of the most courageous political leaders we have now. I know that's not popular in some sectors of America, but I think that what he was able to do is to nationalize that issue, mm-hmm. and to let the people in Boston and New York and everywhere else in Martha's Vineyard know that there's a real problem here.
Well,
and no city is probably dealing with it in a poorer way than Chicago.
My son's a San Antonio police officer, and of course his wife is Mexican, and her she's a lawyer, and her parents were born in Mexico, and they live on the border, and in their town, like half the population are people who have come across the border. Incidentally, her parents are Trump supporters, okay? All right, and so because Trump did well among the Mexicans. Right now in Chicago, I won the Latino vote, okay? And right now in Chicago, in the immigrant community, there's a lot of resentment to the way the migrants are being handled and the way they're being supported. Let me tell you, look,
By the way, let me just mention for those around the country, the feeling in the African-American communities, and they've been very vocal, they've been on television a lot, they do not like the way in which Mayor Johnson, who defeated you, is handling this, because he seems to be bending over backwards to help the migrants, and a lot of poor people who've been here and waiting for government services in the African-American community, they've been shoved to the side.
Well, the problem in Chicago is the city council is not dominated by real socialists, left-wingers, and the mayor has echoed these remarks. They say that the migrant crisis is a product of racist American foreign policy, quote unquote. Those are not my words. Those are the mayor's words. The Venezuelans who are leaving that socialist paradise are coming to the United States, the racist United States. I mean, so that's the rhetoric that you're hearing. Look, I said, and I started doing op-eds on this long before it became a crisis situation. What I would have done as mayor is the following. I would have called Abbott. I would have said, I'm going to support you on the border. I would have also said that any buses coming from Texas or migrants being flown here from Texas, the buses are going to be confiscated. They're going to be fined. Let the bus companies try to get their buses out of the car pound. Believe me, they'll never come here again. And airlines who are bringing migrants who are undocumented are going to be fined. And I would have said, look, we will agree to take some, but we can't be overwhelmed. So at the end of the day, I would have closed ranks on the need to lobby for a strong border policy. And Biden can do a lot of stuff through executive order right now. He doesn't have to do legislation to really secure the border. And then the second thing I would have done is I would have given people temporary work permits. And temporary vendor permits so that they could open up their stands or go
Paul,
to work right away.
Isn't the administration – what you are saying right now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the Brandon Johnson administration is putting those in motion.
They're trying to do it, but they're
and don't get me wrong, Paul. Yeah. Your ideas of what you're saying is great terms of what you're saying, but you know and I know that legislating versus – talking about it are two completely different ball games here.
Well, look, as we know, the mayor's office is, I mean, the government, Chicago government is like Imperial Rome. The mayor is like the emperor, and the city council is like the Roman Senate. They're pretty much docile, and even the historically unpopular Lightfoot never lost a vote in the city council. So at the end of the day, on the one hand, they boast that we're a sanctuary city, and as a sanctuary city, we're not going to work with ISIS, and we're not going to investigate people's backgrounds, and we're not going to crack down on illegal migrants, and we're just going to tell the federal government where to go. Let me just finish
this. Would you have done
that? I want to do the flip side. Let me do the flip side. So on the one hand, we're saying as a sanctuary city, we're not going to cooperate with the federal government on issues pertaining to public safety. But then on the other hand, oh, my God, we can't give these people work permits. We can't give them temporary work permits or temporary vendor license because the federal government hasn't signed off yet. So on the one hand, we're a big, tough sanctuary city, and we're not going to cooperate on public safety. But then on the other hand, we're not going to do what we should be doing.
But we also can't forget, though, is that Mayor Johnson – and by the way, I'm coming from a regular natural perspective here. Mm-hmm. Mayor Johnson inherited this. He walked into this where the buses were coming and the flights were coming. And now, just now, finally, they're starting to what appears to get it under control. And I think no matter who, with respect to you as well, Paul, if you were mayor as well, I got to tell you, you would have your hands full trying to deal with this.
There's no doubt. But the problem, the numbers have increased almost threefold, number one. And they've continued to say, we are a welcoming city. We are a welcoming city.
That's what Rob –
exactly.
I think we got a pitch here from Paul here for the next election for mayor. Yeah. That's what we got here.
We should also mention the sanctuary city idea goes back to Harold Washington. Harold Washington is the one that first said that city police officers were not going to cooperate with INS. And it's gone beyond that to, providing, clothing and housing.
Well, when you look at...
We're out of time. Sorry. Okay. We'll have you back on. our thanks this evening to Paul Vallis, who ran for mayor of the city of Chicago and also spent some considerable time in Haiti, who shared his thoughts on the situation with the Haitians. Bruno Barron has also been here this evening. Bruno, thank you very much. And Rush Darwish, who is a Palestinian businessman in the Chicagoland area. Our thanks to Fritz Goldman for his assistance in tonight's program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.